This is Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're listening Thursday, you're honed in on the Ideas Network. You're catching the Echo version on Friday. It's the News and Classical Music Network that's bringing it to you. We appreciate your investment in WPR, your time, and possibly your resources. It's what literally keeps this vessel on course. I'm Al Ross. Let's get underway with the weekly rendition of Spectrum West, where we look in the mirror and out the window at the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin. This week, author Nicholas Butler is here with a look at what it takes to write a novel like his newest, The Hearts of Men, a newsstand soon. Literature stays in the spotlight, this time from the perspective of striving writers working to better their craft. Write Club is one of many writing groups in our midst, and a founder, Amy Johnson, will be here. Jim Oliver talks with Deb Brown, now in the director's chair for a comedy from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. And here is our point of embarkation. Having had one of our own as Wisconsin's poet laureate, we've come to feel a certain connection to the standing. So as our newest settles into the role, it feels right to get to know her better. Her name is Carla Houston. She's originally from western Wisconsin, a bit south in West Salem to be exact, and now lives in the progressive urban confluence of the Fox Cities, specifically Appleton. It appears from your resume that you decided to get your bachelor's and master's degrees and become a teacher a bit later in life. Am I reading your chronology correctly there?
Yep. My husband and I moved to Appleton in 1987 with two young children. And, I was the Brownie Scout leader and the Girl Scout leader and the computer mom. And, it just got to the point where my husband said, "Why don't you go back to school?" And I thought, this is not going to be easy, but I did it. I went back to school, actually had 42 credits from UW-La Crosse that transferred over. I guess I always wanted to be an English teacher, so that's the course I set out for myself, determined, at the end of the process that I was going to get a job, and I did. Hired in 1994 to teach at Nina High School.
Mm-hmm.
The creative writing teacher left for an opportunity in another part of the state, and the department chair asked me if I wanted to teach it. I said, yes, I would love to. I had kind of an interest in the back of my head, and so I said yes, and the rest is history, I guess. It took me probably another 8 or 10 years to get a master's degree, because it's hard to do when you're working full-time.
Sure.
I wanted to teach writing and really believed in the writing process. So when you're teaching writing, you have to ask students to write, and then you have to respond to their writing. So it becomes a lot of work.
So the writing and the poetry have been a sidekick of yours for a long time, or did it travel the same path as your formal education?
Because there was no room in my undergraduate degree for a creative writing class, which I really wanted to try.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated, I signed up for a continuing education class, and it was just called Creative Writing, taught by Laurel Mills, wonderful poet and fiction writer. I came into that class as a fiction writer, and I think I walked out the door as a poet. My first poem was written for that class. I spent 2 hours at my computer writing this little poem and had the most fun I think I've ever had. I just loved agonizing over every word, listening to the sounds of words and the way they bounced off of each other.
Hmm.
I was hooked.
Wow, I don't know if I've ever heard loved and agonizing in the same phrase.
I think agonized probably meaning that I was scratching my head and
sure.
spent a lot of time in this Emily Dickinson's poetic trance. I was just so enamored with the process.
Hmm. You and I are contemporaries. I've shared conversations with my peers about how, having been raised and influenced by things like the 60s and all the social revolutions we experienced, might have or did influence who and what we became. How much credit do the early years of your life get for shaping the Carla of today?
Oh, I think a lot of credit. I was speaking to someone a little while ago about the influences of my mother and grandmother in my poetry. And, I grew up in the 50s when women were happily homemakers and wives and mothers. But the 60s, gave young women an opportunity to imagine they could be something else, something in addition, which was not something that, my mother said, I never really knew that there would be anything else that I would be interested in doing. So I think she was a bit envious, but I think she also saw how much work it took to try to do everything.
Yeah.
But definitely, and I love to go back to those times and use music, for example. I think I have a poem with to a Donovan song. I heard the music and something just struck me, and out came my pencil and I was away writing.
Mm-hmm. Poet laureate of a state is quite an honor and quite a responsibility, so you can facetiously thank those who submitted your name for nomination. With Max Garland, a relative neighbor here in western Wisconsin, I know for what you will be responsible. It includes a bunch of travel, speaking, and flesh pressing. Have you had a taste of that already?
A little bit. I'm just starting to get rolling with some of those projects. March and April are starting to fill up. I'm also going to be working with various memory cafe projects throughout the Fox Valley and hopefully into the state. So in addition to speaking and reading, I'm going to be trying to get into some of these memory cafes and use poetry as a touchstone for people who are suffering from mild memory loss. I think poetry has that ability to flip a memory trigger like music does.
Yeah.
Getting older in our youth-based culture is in and of itself a lonely process.
Yeah.
And those who suffer from memory loss, it can be terribly isolating for them and terribly fraught, I think, for their caregivers with, the guilt of wanting to do the right thing, but the frustrations of not knowing what to do. So these kinds of groups, they're really social events with some kind of a program, music, art, speakers. But these are a way of getting those suffering from mild memory loss out into the community.
Mm-hmm.
And then these memory cafe projects help work with various community organizations on, how to deal with people who are suffering from memory loss.
Yep. Speaking with Carla Houston, she is our current Wisconsin poet laureate. Carla, we should ask you to recite something so that we can get a taste for what it is you do so very well. Would you grace us with a verse?
I would love to. I've got a couple of poems, one about my mother and one about my father.
Okay.
The first one is called Love That Red. The mouths of their tubes open, luscious tongues reaching. I'm drawn to them, the thick color embedded and shaped, the sheen glistening, the slanted tips fat with promise. My mother wore Love That Red, and when she put it on, I knew she was going farther than the clothesline or the edge of our corner lot. Knew the way her lips pursed, that love it or not, red was her color. The way it lit her brown eyes, and she was taking all of it with her. And then my father, a musician from the La Crosse area for many, many years, played in a polka band. And this one is for him. It's called My Father's Horns. Saturday nights he jammed the van, the upright silver bass or the curly sousaphone. Back then, the gang played standards, some oompa-pas and little waltzes, and packed the dance floor with suits and circle skirts. Sometimes a pretty woman sang. My father drove home after, half asleep, a little jazzed, his throat choked with smoke. The horns, their big bells silent, settled once more in the back. Those Saturday night beauties, the ones he held tight, the ones he crooned to. My mother keeping time at home.
I had a chance to pre-read that one, and that's wonderful, both of them. It's so nice that people can honor their parents in the ways that you're doing. Do you find that they and your past turn out to be subjects of things that you write often?
My parents, I think probably more so. My grandparents also, because they're all gone now. There's got to be a reason for me to go back that direction, I guess. Maybe even writing about the thing. For example, I love fountain pens, and I have a collection of a half a dozen fountain pens and was thinking about where I would put them. And I found a box, a tin box set with an old candy box from the 20s that my parents had and I dumped the contents out and filled it up with fountain pens and then sat down to write a poem about it.
Oh, wow.
You know, I wondered where that box came from. Of course, there's no one to ask where that box came from. And so now I get to imagine and make it up.
Your publications, Carla, and chapbooks have interesting titles like A Theory of Lipstick and Grief Bone. A lot of work goes into poetry. How much goes into titles?
Oh, man, titles are an agonizing thing. Sometimes you have the title, then you write the poem, and sometimes you have the poem and you're tearing your hair out for that title. Sometimes you have to ask somebody else for a suggestion. Laurel Mills told me a long time ago that she didn't have a title for a poem. She put the poem next to her bed before she fell asleep. She asked the muses to give her a title. And when she woke up in the morning, there it would be.
Huh.
It's kind of, you know, kind of voodoo-ish. But titles are sometimes easy and sometimes really hard.
Uh-huh. And you have to live with them.
You do.
Well, I'm going to ask you to lay another poem on us, and you sent one prior, one called Vestige, and
yes.
I think that's about as poignant as a poem can get, so I would wish that you would share that with our audience.
I would be happy to do that. Vestige. The day I found my father in his house, the old clock had stopped chiming. His dog, withered from lack of water, shivered in the middle of the room. Dried puddles marking the rug. Later, she lay near his chair and wouldn't come to my call. Today, in my father's house, a spider works in and out of the lace curtains, making something unreadable of thin silk. She drops to the floor, looking for a way out. I do not have the heart to kill her.
See, that's a wow poem.
Thank you.
Does it feel way to you? What do you feel like after reading that? Of course, you wrote it. Do you write joyful poems as well?
Sure.
Okay, sure. Because
I do. My newest book, Grief Bone, is about loss,
okay.
However, and that's one of those poems. This poem was like a little poetic gift. Somebody came along and handed it to me, and I feel sad when I think about it. In my father's house, tasked with the job of settling his estate and, you know, finding myself there among all of his things and not having him there makes me feel sad. So I guess, you know, the idea of loss, you know, inherent in the poem, but the poem doesn't come out and say that. I let the images do the talking.
You've done a marvelous job of capturing the experience. Congratulations, Carla Houston, on your lofty position. I do hope you'll visit this part of the state frequently during your 2-year reign. I know you're going to find this part of the left half of Wisconsin is home to some very creative folks and very welcoming folks. So we look forward to meeting you someday. Again, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Carla Houston, poet laureate of our state of Wisconsin. She said she's coming to the next Chippewa Valley Book Festival for a personal visit, and you can get to know her better today at her website, Carla Houston, that's H-U-S-T-O-N, and Carla with a K, .com. Nick Butler on his new novel, Write Club, and their process of helping writers improve their skills, and Jim Oliver next on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, with Confluence, geography, history, and culture at the intersection of the Mississippi and the Minnesota rivers. Photographs by Luke Erickson through April 16th, mmam.org. Support also comes from Marquardt Toyota, offering the all-wheel drive Highlander, an SUV committed to reliability. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, or at marquardttoyota.com. Well, Debbie Brown's been our volunteer and events coordinator for a while, and just Tuesday we had her going away party. She wants to devote more time to her passion for theater, including more writing, but it's theater in general as well, as she recently ended an onstage run and now dives back into directing. And who better to share that kind of excitement than Jim Oliver?
Playwrights Jesse Jones, Nicholas Hope, and Jamie Wooten have hit upon a pattern for writing successful plays for live theater, tapping into the community theater market. They've given us plays like The Dixie Swim Club, Southern Hospitality, The Hallelujah Girls, Till Beth Do Us Part, and The Red Velvet Cake, among others. They've also entered into another aspect of community theater popularity, Christmas shows, like Christmas Bells and Dashing Through the Snow. Included in that Others category is Always a Bridesmaid, which will be open March 9th by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild. In the studio to talk about Always a Bridesmaid is the director, Debbie Brown. Well, thank you for making the trip over here.
Oh, no problem.
Another factor in their success in community theater is their plays are comedies and have lots of parts for women. Keep that in mind, directors-to-be. Tell us about how Always a Bridesmaid fits into all of that.
Well, one of the things that attracted me to the show was the fact that it was all women, and I thought that would be fun to work with the cast and include six characters. My assistant director is also female, so there's eight of us working each night, and we laugh a lot. It's really fun, and the fact that the characters are so different from each other, but there's an overranging theme of friendship and supporting each other. The play is not going to be a play that's going to bring someone down. This play is fun. This play is about love and the adventures that friends get into. It's really fun.
A writer for the Denver Post wrote, "Always a Bridesmaid at its best is amusing, but more often feels like a compilation of scenes cut because they weren't funny enough for the Golden Girls." Wooten wrote for the Golden Girls TV show. On the other hand, a writer for the Burlington, North Carolina Times News wrote, "That is a feel-good show that will leave you smiling hours after it's over." Now, all that reminds me of those of us who toil for small community newspapers have come to dislike the arrogance of big city writers, hence the Denver Post. Anyway, tell us what the play is about.
Let me comment on the review first. If you were just to read the play, I think you might come away that this play is rather shallow and the characters are two-dimensional. But seeing it performed and with the talented cast that we have, it brings so much depth to the story. It's really wonderful. The story is about four friends who in high school promised to be in each other's weddings. And because there are more than one wedding in these people's lives, they tend to repeat their performances as bridesmaids. So each of the scenes features a particular wedding. Besides the four friends, there's also the daughter of one of the friends and then the owner of the wedding venue. Mm. So that makes up the six people.
Mm-hmm. You brought up the cast members. Who are the cast members?
The four friends are Kim Butnick, she plays Libby Ruth, the hopeless romantic. Angie Alexander plays Deidre, the professional, no-nonsense person. Sue Fulch is Charlie, the landscaper, the only single gal in the group. Emily Anderlich plays Monette, who is self-centered and flashy and trashy, too. A very fun role for her. Jean Kusrow-Larsen, who people know from the Menominee Theater Guild, is playing Sedalia. And Angela Allred is playing Kari. They're just wonderful to work with.
Mm-hmm. She is Debbie Brown, who is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Always a Bridesmaid. Well, talk a little bit about the technical crew. Are there a lot of technical aspects to the show, the set and all that kind of thing? Is it pretty complicated, or do you try to keep it simple?
Well, yes and no. The set is pretty simple. There's one little aspect. I have visions of how it's going to work. The worker on the set keeps telling me that it may be possible and may not. Because this deals with weddings and bridesmaids, this is a very costume-heavy show. And luckily, I've run across some magicians with needles and thread, so they've been able to rework some of the existing costumes. I've been able to borrow a costume from the university in order to wardrobe these six ladies in all these different settings.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your theatrical background. I know you've acted, directed, and were a puppeteer. Or maybe still are, for that matter.
I didn't get into theater, really, until my kids were little. When they were in preschool, I noticed that it was difficult to take preschoolers to events, to shows, because you had to corral them. And I thought, you know, if shows would come to schools, that would be much easier. So why not a puppet theater that I could travel around with? So that got me into puppets. And no, I really don't do puppets anymore. I'm getting a little old to get down on my knees and hide behind the set. So don't do much of that, although I would like to incorporate that into a regular live stage show at some point. But I've done performing on stage, and this is my second venture into directing. Since I'm retiring in a couple days from WPR, I would like to focus more on writing for stage and for reading and storytelling and that kind of thing.
Now, I know from personal experience that you were involved in an effort to bring Reader's Theater to the Senior Center here in Eau Claire. I know you eventually turned that into a women's Reader's Theater.
Right. It's sort of a couple different branches of the same thing. So we have the Eau Claire Women in Theater. We do public performances of dramatic reading. And then there's an aspect of it. People in senior living communities and at the senior center, we coach them through a Reader's Theater experience. We're hoping to expand on that. It probably won't happen until this fall, by the time we get everything organized. But we're hoping to be able to travel around to different communities and different venues in order to let more people experience the fun that we really have.
Now, you talked about writing. I've been writing my memoir at the behest of my wife for the last 12 years, I guess. It's making some progress, but not much. And so every so often I run into somebody who either has completed their memoir or is almost finished with it. So what kind of writing are you talking about?
Well, that may be part of it. Mm-hmm. Because I really like the idea of dramatic reading, mm-hmm. I would like to expand on that and encourage you to share a little vignette from your memoir. Those are just so wonderful to present, and to do it in a dramatic fashion for an audience is just a wonderful way to connect drama, personal experience, writing. So, yeah, let me read it.
Right now it's in all kinds of bits and pieces all over the place. I used to write columns for a living, and that, you know, all those are around. And
well, there
some
you
of
go.
Them, some of them were pretty good and some weren't so good.
I also dabble a little bit in poetry. Know a lot of very talented poets in town. That's also a fun genre to do as a public reading.
Well, getting back to what we're supposed to be talking about here, the play is Always a Bridesmaid. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production will be staged March 9th to the 12th and 16th through the 19th at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can call 715-832-PLAY or online at www.cvtg.org. And we've been talking to the director, Debbie Brown. As this is being recorded in advance, Debbie is still the volunteer and event coordinator for Wisconsin Public Radio in Eau Claire. So I hope you've noticed that I've been treating her with the utmost respect in my role as a volunteer and one of her loyal underlings. When this is finally broadcast, she will have left WPR, much to the great disappointment of all who have had the privilege to have worked with her. Best wishes, Debbie. Uh-huh. I hope you will continue to direct and act and write and whatever else you feel like doing, and to favor Spectrum West with an occasional appearance.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now I can go out and start trying to get on the good side of Kate, your replacement, as the new volunteer and special events coordinator.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, his new novel comes out next week. Nicholas Butler talks about it and what it takes. That's coming up. For now, as we continue to feature writers' groups flourishing in this region of the state, I'm impressed, and you might be too, with the sheer number of those in existence. There's no shortage of outlets with which to sharpen your skills. This week, it's Write Club, an Eau Claire-based troupe with a few years under their belts, represented in an enjoyable conversation by Amy Johnson. And maybe you didn't know that November is National Novel Writing Month. Couple hours on the first and third Sunday of every month is when you get together.
Yep. We've been around for a while. I think we started around like 2011, 2012. I'm the municipal liaison for National Novel Writing Month in City of Eau Claire. So every November, I help organize the local writers in the area who want to get together and participate in National Novel Writing Month. And the idea is to write 50,000 words in 30 days. Mm. And so basically, I'm just like a big cheerleader that keeps people going and keeps people motivated. It's a fun little way for people to get together and try out writing and try out being a writer. But the people that I was doing it with kind of wished that something would go on beyond just November. So we got together and we thought, well, why don't we start a club? We'll get together and we'll cheer each other on, but we'll also critique each other's work, too, because you don't do any critiquing with National Novel Writing Month. So we decided to call ourselves Write Club, kind of a play on words for Fight Club. We meet the first and third Sunday of every month. We've kind of hopped around different places, but now we're at the library, 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock at the library. Yeah, we're a critique-based group. Come in with stuff that we're working on, works in progress, and we read them to the group, and then we take turns giving feedback, encouragement, tips on how to make it sound better, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah, and you have a group that physically connects, and there's a bunch more involved electronically.
Yeah. We have about 80 members on our Facebook group. We share articles, you know, tips on how to, you know, stay motivated writing, how to improve your grammar, how to improve plot structure. But we also talk about like trends in the industry, or we just give a shout out, say, hi, I'm lonely. You know, like I want to talk to another writer, you know, because writing is kind of a lonely endeavor. So it's just nice to know that there's a community out there that you can talk to for support if you need it.
I'm glad you clarified the association to Fight Club. I was going to ask if it was a takeoff on that. And then I was going to say, but hopefully it's only in the name, not the reputation.
Right. Yeah, we thought it'd be funny if we had like sparring or something, but we don't.
So you welcome writers of all levels, experiences, and genres. As you said, you're a critique-based group that offers encouragement as well as constructive feedback. These are quotes that I'm reading from mm-hmm. a description of your group. You are warm and welcoming. And then I put warm and welcoming, ... until you read something.
I think part of the reason I started Write Club was I had a hard time finding a writer's group. There wasn't a lot at the time. Now there's a lot of writer's group to choose from, and that's awesome. But mm-hmm. at the time when I first moved here, there weren't a lot of writer's group to choose from. And I think sometimes it's a little intimidating to walk into a writer's group, especially if a lot of the writers are, you know, published or they're in academia. Not that they're not welcoming, but it can be a little intimidating, I think, for the new writer to walk in on that kind of a setting. And we have writers from all different backgrounds and all kind of experience levels. So we just want to stress that we're just a really friendly bunch. You can come in and it doesn't matter if you've only written two words in your whole life or a million of them. We just want you to come and hang out and mm-hmm. share what you have. Yeah.
Amy Johnson on the phone with us, and she is one of the instigators behind a writer's group called Write Club. The existence of writing groups interests me from a few perspectives. I should warn you that I've seldom been called a great team player, so maybe that's just exactly where this is coming from, but it's a vantage point nonetheless. Discussion and critique is part of most group efforts. Tell us how a writer reacts to constructive criticism, especially if he or she is very proud of what they've written and can't wait to read it. If it's panned, is there a learning curve there too, like developing a thicker skin and an ability to take suggestions and mold something better?
Yeah, you definitely have to have a thick skin if you want to start writing and start receiving feedback and critiques. But really, the only way to grow as a writer is to get that feedback, whether it's good or bad. And I think when a writer reaches a point where they want to start taking their writing seriously, they know that they're going to have to take the good with the bad criticisms. And it can be a tough blow to get bad feedback, but it's just an opportunity to get better. I think even bad feedback is a little bit better than no feedback. Uh-huh. I think all of us as writers, I think we have friends and family and we share what we have and all we get is, oh, that was really nice, or oh, wow, you're a writer. And I think that's more disappointing than constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. I think if you share your stuff and someone says, wow, I like that, but this didn't make sense or this didn't make sense, then it's like, wow, somebody read it and they cared about it and they understand what I'm trying to do as a writer. And so I think that's helpful, even if it isn't what you want to hear.
Sure. I've always wondered how often someone wrote an actual masterpiece and then changed it because of input from within a group of peers. Like changed it to something that doesn't have masterpiece potential anymore. You know, that's just the weird side of me. I asked that about art and sculpture on last week's program, how deeply one should consider criticism, or whether art, in your case, literature, shouldn't simply be tossed out there to live or die on its own merits.
I like that you brought up, art and sculpture. I was just talking to somebody about this a little while ago. The unique thing about writing as a hobby, I think, is that we have this idea that you should be amazing at it right away, because we read books from our favorite authors and it's great stuff, but we don't see all of the horrible drafts that they went through to get to this great thing. And I think when you start out as a writer, you think, okay, I need to make those words sound as awesome as my role models do. Mm-hmm. And it never happens. The first draft of everything is awful. That's the hardest thing, I think, for writers and non-readers to wrap their mind around.
Sure.
Is that you're going to be awful for many, many drafts before it starts sounding good.
Mm-hmm.
But at least with like sculpture or art, you have something to compare it to. You can see yourself growing and you have a physical thing to look at and compare it to other things. Whereas words are a lot more abstract. So it's hard to have that benchmark that you're getting better. Mm-hmm. And I think it can be very frustrating because you want to jump from really bad writing to really great writing as quickly as possible. And it's a slow process, and it's not always as clearly defined as it is with like a sculpture or a painting.
I noted the quote was, "Most people write for enjoyment." Another one of my cynical lines in my notes was, "Once someone suggests that you change something that you thought was pretty good, does the enjoyment subside?"
That's a good point. Yeah, that is hard when you're really proud of a passage and other people didn't find it as exciting as you.
Carla Houston, the Wisconsin Poet Laureate, she used the line, she loved agonizing over her poetry. I thought that was the first time I ever heard the two words loved agonizing together, as if they fit together. But I suppose writing is a process that begins with you hear something or you see something, you say, I got to write it down. And after you write it, that's the enjoyable part. There's a synthesis going on. But then, in order for it to be good, then the work begins.
Yeah. But I think that that part is just as enjoyable as well. Obviously, the first time you write it, you should write for yourself and not think about what other people are going to think, because you want to just get it out as raw and real as you can. But then after that, there is kind of enjoyment in chiseling away at it and reforming it and creating something that other people would enjoy too.
Sure.
As much as it might pain me to cut a part that I like but nobody else likes, it does feel good, though, to know that more people are going to like what I have written than just that one little part is worth. And I think that's with any kind of a craft. You can do it at home and enjoy it, but then eventually if you want to get better and better at it or show it off to people, the process becomes a lot of fun, I think, just learning different tricks and how to do different things and how to get better at it.
And if it wasn't fun, you wouldn't have members.
Right, exactly.
in the Write Club. So enough of my sullen inquiries. How does someone join Write Club?
Well, you just show up. You don't have to go through any kind of hoops or anything. I know sometimes some writers groups, and for good reason, they might ask somebody to submit a sample or to, you know, do a little, almost like an interview kind of a thing. But nope, we're just pretty laid back. We're really eclectic. So we might not be a good group for everybody. We're not as serious maybe as other writers groups are. So someone who really wants to get a fast track into publishing might not enjoy our slow pace, but we just kind of want to enjoy what we're doing. A lot of us are kind of hobby writers. We want to get better as writers, but we're not chomping at the bit to go out and get published, kind of doing it just for the fun and to have friends that kind of get what we are about. So
Okay. Yeah,
you can just show up and try us out. And if you like our style, you're welcome to stay. And if not, then no hard feelings.
Yeah. Give us the place and times again.
Yeah, we're at the Eau Claire Public Library, down in the basement in the Cedar Room, or the Chippewa Room. We're down in the basement. There's signs. There's a sign right outside, but we're in the basement of the Eau Claire Library, first and third Sunday of every month from 1 to 3 o'clock.
Amy Johnson, right? Thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum Wested. Good luck with Write Club. Keep the fires going and let us know of people's successes as time goes on.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's fun stuff. You're listening to Spectrum West on WPR. Wonder what's on stage in Western Wisconsin? Well, I won't be wondering much longer. Here's Jim Oliver.
Thanks, Al. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present the musical Winnie the Pooh Friday through Sunday at the Oxford Theater. Everybody's Hero, the Jackie Robinson story, will be presented by the Mad River Theater Works of Zanesfield, Ohio, Sunday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Old Gem Theater of New Richmond will present 1,000 Clowns for student audiences weekdays through March 24th. A performance for the general public is scheduled for March 10th. Larceny and Old Lace, a spoof of the classic play Arsenic and Old Lace, will be staged March 10th through the 12th at the Erica Kwan Memorial Theater in Shell Lake. The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Theater will present Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, through Sunday at the Gantner Concert Hall, Haas Fine Arts Center at the University. The Marvelous Marvelettes will open March 10th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will continue weekends through May 20th. The Menominee Theater Guild will present The Secret Garden Friday through Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Hey! Eau Claire native, Shell Lake Arts Camp alum, and in-demand New York jazz guitarist Pete McCann is bringing his quartet to the Lakely in the Oxbow Hotel in downtown Eau Claire next Wednesday, March 8th at 8 p.m. What do you say we have an hors d'oeuvre? Here they are. That is good stuff. Pete McCann and his quartet, the Lakely Oxbow Hotel, next Wednesday, the 8th. He's been on the show before. Will be again. Nicholas Butler, riding the wave of a best-selling novel, Shotgun Love Songs, a compilation of people and stories beneath the bonfire, and now novel 2, The Hearts of Men, is quickly becoming the familiar, respected author, but also a man who loves writing, loves and puts family first, is proud of where he comes from, and finds a way to incorporate all of it into work that gets and deserves enthusiastic reviews. As the official release date nears, he cordially accepted our invitation to stop by, and I'm not known as a prolific reader of fiction, you should know. But I'm happy to say that yours is now back in the shelf, having been digested.
Yay. I really do appreciate that. Yeah, it's, you know, this is the first radio interview I think I'm doing for this book, and so it's just it's nice to be in studio with you again and get some warm fuzzies already. So,
as I read the book, I used a 3x5 card as a bookmark. On it, I took notes. I'll be referring to those notes here. You're going to do a bunch of interviews about this book, and apart from wanting this conversation to be unique, I don't want to ask anything that might end up giving away too much about the plot. So knowing you have a good grasp of the story, what's behind it, and what's safe to say without any needless leaking going on a lot these days.
Nobody wants any leaking.
No, we sure don't, especially at my age. And then I'll refer to my notes, which are kind of more philosophical. The book is divided into 4 parts, each moving forward in time, and there are 48 chapters. How does the format of a book happen? Is that something that's pre-planned, or you just sort of look at it when you're finished and say, I got to divide it up this way?
I think the honest answer to that question is that I'm 37 years old. This is the third book that I've written. I'm still trying to figure out how to do things. Shotgun Love Songs, you know, each chapter was divided up by the narrator. You could tell who was narrating it because I had put a letter at the top of the page. With this book, I knew that it was going to travel through time. I really saw it as happening in three big acts. As you say, there's a smaller fourth act.
Yeah.
I didn't know really how to divide up the action except for these simple sort of chapters.
Now, as I said, my questions tend to ask about the author more than about the book. So I consider my questions much more biological, the hands and mind that produce the work. Once you're finished with a novel, does it stay with you as if you actually lived it? Does it feel like a memory to you?
No. The weird thing about this job, for me anyway, you know, you spend 2-3 years physically working on the book.
Uh-huh.
There could be, you know, decades of time thinking about the book. But then once I finish it, I'm thinking about the next project.
Oh, yeah.
And I have to just kind of keep moving forward. So what's funny is that sometimes somebody will ask me about a character or an event that happens in the book, and I really have to take a moment
to think about it
mm-hmm. because they're imaginary people that sort of happened in a long dream somewhere in my life, and I've since moved past it. I've worked through those issues.
Imaginary, yet probably developed from characteristics of someone that you knew or have known in the past?
Sure. You know,
that's a stock question, but I think that's
it's
true.
And it's something people want to know about too, of course. I mean, all these characters probably contain parts of me. Some of them contain parts of other people or are sort of modeled after other people, and some of them are completely imaginary. And the other thing that I try and kind of caution people is that if you look at a fictional character in a Nick Butler book mm-hmm. and immediately connect that to Nick Butler or Nick Butler's mom or Nick
yes.
Butler's dad or yeah. Nick Butler's brother, you sort of lose some of the fun because this is your
yeah.
artifact, your book to own and to imagine as you will. And what's the fun of just connecting it to a real-life person? That's why we read nonfiction.
The reason I bring up characters is Nelson, mm-hmm. he begins actually as the main character and develops as kind of the patriarch of the book's family. Young Nelson was a pretty unique individual. Did you know a Nelson who was like this Nelson in your lifetime after whom you fashioned this one?
I grew up going to Boy Scout camp every summer, probably between the ages of 8 to 17. And I knew kids that were like Nelson, I think it's fair to say, but I wasn't Nelson. I don't really have any friends that were Nelson. A book that played a big role in me thinking about how to write The Hearts of Men was Lord of the Flies. Most American kids, I feel like, read that book between the ages of, say, 12 and 16, middle school to early high school. And for some reason, I never read it during that time. I read it probably 4 or 5 years ago, and it really disturbed me. I thought it was fantastic. It's now one of my favorite books, but it's disturbing and more so, I think, because I now have a 7.5-year-old son, and you're thinking about him reaching this age when children can be so terrible to one another.
Mm.
So I think that you know, definitely played a role in who Nelson is.
So you brought up Boy Scouts. That's some of your experience, but there was a certain amount of research required for this book. I mean,
yes.
you had to know some baseball facts.
Mm-hmm.
You had to know some military facts.
Yes.
You had to know some things about the 1960s, and you
yes.
did not grow up in the 1960s.
No, sir, I did not.
I did, as a matter of fact. Is research a fun part of writing a book, or is it kind of the drudgery daily grind of it?
Research can become a black hole for a fiction writer. It can become something where, you know, you tell yourself or you tell your spouse, oh, I'm researching for my book today. And what ends up happening is that you fall down these black holes or these labyrinths on the internet and you're not doing the work of writing. For this book, research became a lot of fun. Baseball is my favorite sport. It's what I was in love with as a kid.
Okay.
And so when I was thinking about corroborating these times in the 1960s, what I did is I went to various websites to come up with actual games that took place in actual years on actual days so that if a person was looking carefully enough, they could find a game where Juan Marichal pitched against.
Sure.
I can't remember who it is in the book, whether it's Warren Spahn or something like that. So that was a blast.
You can get caught up doing too much research.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah. Nobody's going to go into Barnes & Noble and buy your research.
Although I found it refreshing to hear a young guy like you able to say things that I knew for fact and had lived through and say them accurately.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you brought up baseball because I'm like so happy to talk about it. And the baseball pitchers and catchers have now reported it feels like we're turning that cosmic corner and headed towards spring.
Boy, there.
I really believe that every successful novel has a ghost somewhere in its pages. And I wasn't sure what the ghost of this book was going to be. And as I was doing research on Chicago Cubs, I came across this player, Ken Hubbs, who won the Rookie of the Year. I can't remember exactly. It was 62 or 64, something like that. He was widely considered to just be like a really kind, generous young man. He donated a lot of his time to young children, but he was deathly afraid of flying. And so he decided that he would teach himself how to fly as a way of overcoming this fear. Sadly, 2 years after he broke into the major leagues, he died in a plane crash. He's kind of part of this Chicago Cubs lore and the bad luck that preceded them before this fall. And when I found out about his story, I thought, that's the ghost in this story. He was a person who seemed to conduct themselves by a kind of code of conduct, by being good and being good on the baseball field, too. And I thought, that's another thing that this book is about. It's about being flawed but trying to become better. It's about having a code. It's about being a man or woman, with shortcomings but trying to sort of overcome those shortcomings.
Yeah, see, there you got into what the book's about. It's such an interwoven fabric of people. It's chronological. It goes as people grow up and have new responsibilities as adults. And then as older people, Nelson actually grows to be an old gentleman. And so I think that's the story that you want to follow. In the studio with Nicholas Butler, he is here to talk about his newest novel. It's called The Hearts of Men. We can say best-selling author. The last one that got accolades was Shotgun Love Songs. If your books, I don't know why I came up with this, if your books were flavors, how is Shotgun Love Song different compared to The Hearts of Men?
Yeah. Well, I think maybe Shotgun Love Songs is like a cold line in Kugels on a hot summer day.
Okay.
I think this book is a little bit more like
The Hearts of Men is.
Like a glass of scotch on an autumn night.
Goes down a little.
It's a little bit more of a refined taste. I don't think it's. I like the idea of you asking me about a flavor rather than like an emotional tonality or something like that. Because the trap a person can get in is, well, this is darker, this is more complicated than a certain, you know, sect of readers, like, I'm out. I think this is a little bit more complicated, a little bit more nuanced. It's me writing a book 5 years after Shotgun Love Songs. I've changed as a person. America has changed as a country. Wisconsin has changed as a state. I can't write Shotgun Love Songs every time. I don't want to write Shotgun Love Songs every time. I need to start, you know, examining what it is to be a person now here.
I see a baseball novel coming, just from what you said. I do have to point out the words, and happily, public radio.
Yeah.
NPR actually do appear.
Oh, yeah.
At least a couple times in the book.
Yeah, several times. Yeah, there's a couple characters, including Rachel, that are big public radio fans and
smart people in the book. You come up with smart characters for your book.
Yeah.
Are you known for elaborate and creative description? Is that something you want to be known for? Like creating a setting or a moment or a mood? Because there were some wonderful ways you described them. I'm going to read a couple. The bicycles lean bored on their kickstands, casually awaiting a decision. Just two angry red taillights receding down the block. Broad as a wildebeest. Wiping the edge of her eyes with her thumb and index finger, first the right, then the left. I thought, wouldn't it be just enough to say wiping her eyes? But you got into description. His head is as fuzzy as a poorly tuned radio. Her breath, he thinks, smells like tequila and lime, possibly Doritos. Those go a little bit further, and they really do engage the reader.
You're trying to engage a reader's senses.
Yeah.
I had a reader complain to me that she, in reference to Shotgun Love Song, she liked my book very much, but she didn't feel like there was enough olfactory stuff happening in the book. She couldn't smell what was happening.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that she was right, but it was okay criticism, because on a move forward, I thought, well, I'm going to make for damn sure that people can smell, see, touch, taste everything that I'm trying to do.
So is that a necessary skill for a novelist, do you think?
Is it a necessary skill? In my mind, I think the most necessary skills are, A, having a good story. okay? A story that's going to compel somebody to keep turning pages. And I think also great characters. People want an emotional connection between themselves and this imaginary person on a page.
Yeah.
Now, if you can give them more than that, if you can engage their senses and their emotions and their brain, then that's bonus.
We're talking with Nicholas Butler, by the way. The Hearts of Men is his latest novel. Is the title taken from something? Is that something very original?
I have to give credit to my editor, Megan Lynch, for the title. The original title was The Faithlessness of Men, which is taken from a James Galvin poem at the beginning of the book. But one could argue that The Faithlessness of Men is a very dark title and one that, you know, folks at the bookstore aren't maybe apt to pick up off the table. So I really dug my heels in for months and months, and I felt that title, The Faithlessness of Men, was what I wanted, and it was true to this James Galvin poem that had given me some inspiration. But I was kind of talked down from that, and I think The Hearts of Men is a better title because it's an emotional book. It's not just about men. It's about men in the sense of people, humankind. It's about women too. So I think it works.
It works very well. I'm just happy you didn't keep The Faithlessness of Men because as a radio guy who would have to say that over and over, that's faithlessness.
I hope my editor's listening in because that was also part of the conversation that it is just difficult to say.
It is, and it makes for a much longer word on the cover.
Right.
I'm trying to imagine. I'm looking at the book now.
Fair enough. I'm looking at it too, and I don't know how they would have done that. Yeah, it's true.
Nick Butler, thanks. Appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Hearts of Men, available very soon at the places where you like to buy your books. Hey, support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association. The Celtic band Solas performs music ranging from traditional tunes to Bob Dylan. Friday, 7:30 at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls, cvca.net is their website. Thanks, Allison, for unscrambling my words, Debbie for the memories, Kate for looking forward, and Dean for charting the course. Next week, it's time for the big improv annual to hit town. We'll have a special guest, Sean Johnson of Tonic Soul Fog, returns for some one-on-one. And you know what? We'll have even more. Because there's always more on Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross for Jim Oliver. All of our guests today, in the past, coming up. Thanks so much. See you next week.